You are listening to ATP Radio with Barry Nussbaum.
Hello and welcome to ATP Radio, our first episode going out nationally. When we get going tonight, I want to remind you, you can call in with questions. The number is 516-595-8069. 516-595-8069. We'll get to as many questions as we can with our special guest, who tonight is Charles Jacobs, one of America's most distinguished scholars on all things relating to Islam, especially in America. He's an author, he's a commentator, he's a scholar, and we're thrilled to have you with us, Charles Jacobs. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Barry.
So let's talk about 9/11 week. It's 19 years have gone by. We are so far removed from the most ferocious attack in hundreds of years on America's homeland. It almost seems like a historical event rather than something that was burned into our consciousness that fateful morning that so many of us that are old enough will never forget. You know, when I saw it and I saw the first plane hit, and then it was on a replay, I was watching the news in the morning in California, and then the second plane, I really felt like there was so much disbelief in my consciousness, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And then it became a bigger story with the Pentagon and then Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Almost 3,000 Americans were dead, and it was obvious that we were under attack. I remember it incredibly clearly. I remember exactly where I was. What were your first thoughts on that morning?
Well, I just missed getting on a plane with the bad guys. I had been planning to go to Washington on 9/11. I was at Logan Airport the evening before, and there was a storm and all planes were stopped. Missed my plane. So I went back to sleep and I got on the earliest plane that I could, or the one that would make it to Washington. The reason I was going, I think is very interesting, relates to this. I was leading a movement to stop the slaughter and enslavement of Black people in Sudan. Many people may remember this, but many of Americans had already learned about and were horrified by news reports of mass murders, the size of which we hadn't seen since World War II, of Blacks in South Sudan. And along with that came news reports of the enslavement, the capture and enslavement of Blacks by the regime in Khartoum. Now, Sudan is Africa's largest country. The North was led by radical Islamists, a Muslim government, who had declared a jihad, a holy war, on the South, which consisted mostly of Christians, Christian Blacks and animists and tribalists and some Muslim Blacks. And I was leading a movement that was educating the Americans about the enslavement of Black people in this time. And we had all thought that slavery was history. And so I was producing shocking reports written by human rights groups, written by our allies in Sudan, about the enslavement of Blacks. And we had gotten lots of, at this time, support from all around the country. And I was flying into Washington on 9/11 to do a press release, a press conference, to convince at Capitol Hill, at a room in the Congress, to convince Congress that they should not allow oil companies, American oil companies, to do business with Sudan. And with me were important leaders of the Black community at the time. There was a guy named Joe Madison, who was one of the heads of the NAACP, and there was a guy named Reverend Walter Fauntroy, who was known to have helped plan Martin Luther King's March on Washington. So there I was with these two Black leaders going to the Congress, and I'm sitting on the plane, and I'm writing my speech, and I'll never forget what I wrote in the speech, which was, Wall Street should not trade the shares of companies who do business with slave and terror state of Sudan. And if we sit here and allow this to happen in Africa, who is to say that radical Islamists won't reach us here as well? That was in my speech. That was in my speech. We landed. We went to the three of us got in the cab. We went to the Congress. We started to set up for the speech in the Congressional Hall. And all of a sudden, on the walls were these huge television screens, and we saw the first plane. This was a news item. We saw the first plane hit the tower, and everybody's saying, "Oh, that the first response was, this must be a small plane, a five-seater mistake by a stupid pilot." And then that immediately disappeared when we saw huge bursts of flame. And then, oh my God, oh my God. The press conference was canceled. People were running all over the place. And then the second plane hit, and we really started to think about bigger things than a mistake by a pilot. And all of a sudden, police came charging into the building, Capitol Police, saying, "Get out, get out. They're headed to the Pentagon, get out." So we raced out of there, terrified. I was with John Eibner, who was the head of Christian Solidarity International, who was leading the movement to buy back slaves from the Arabs, from the jihadists. And he and I, running through the streets of Washington, had a terrible thought that if this was actually an invasion or an attack on American soil, we were both known as people who they would particularly not like. And so we got a little nervous for ourselves, but mostly for our families. I tried to call my wife back in Boston. None of the cell phones were working because everybody in the world was calling his wife or his loved ones. We were racing through the streets of Washington, wondering what to do. I finally got my wife on the phone. My kids went to Jewish day school. I thought the worst of thoughts that this was an Islamic attack on America. I told my wife to get the kids out of the school immediately. As it turned out, a terrible thing happened. My younger daughter, Ariella, was a classmate of a child whose father was killed on the plane. He was the, and I'm forgetting his name now, but he was the Israeli military trained guy who, you probably heard this, he heard two of the hijackers speaking in Arabic. He understood what they were doing. He stood up to confront them, and he had his throat slashed. And that was my daughter's classmate's father. Oh, so I will never forget that day for 100 reasons. Eibner and I holed up in a hotel that night, and we took a train because you couldn't fly back to New York, well, back to Boston. And we drove as the train passed through the New York area, we saw the plumes of smoke and ash, and I'll never forget that scene as well. So for me, this was a trauma that deeply affected me. I was there, and I went back to what I had written that day. I was going to say in Congress, if you let this happen to the Blacks in Sudan, and if the jihad continues, what's to say it wouldn't come here? And it did.
Well, you were truly prophetic in your thoughts. And it's unfortunate you didn't get to make that speech. Maybe it would have landed a little stronger, because we're going to talk about it later in this show. It sure seems that the lessons that should have been learned, quite sadly, 19 years later, the main ones we're going to talk about, Charles, have not been learned. So,
and still haven't. And still haven't.
Exactly. And let's talk about Islam in specifics. 19 men, almost all from Saudi Arabia, perpetrated 4 extremely devastating attacks for virtually no money and a little bit of pilot training, and changed the world forever. And I don't just mean the roughly 3,000 people that they murdered, but when you think about the devastation of the world economy and travel and airline security and the way we look at travel now worldwide, it has cost, I've heard incredible estimates, billions into the trillions. Let's talk specifically about the philosophy that encouraged these guys to do this. It bothers me greatly, Charles, when people sort of make it less than it was, in the sense that, well, these were just crazy guys. These were radicals. These aren't real Muslims. When in reality, when I look at it, to be a radical Muslim is someone who doesn't follow the Quran. That would be a reformed Muslim. A religious Muslim follows all the dictates of Muhammad, whether it's in the Quran, the Hadith, whatever, because those words are supposedly perfect, directly from God. And part of the precept of the religion is to wage the various forms of jihad. What do you say to people 19 years later that say, well, those were just the crazy radicals because they weren't real Muslims, they were jihadists?
Well, in fact, they were the realest of real Muslims, because they were following what was and what is traditional teachings and precepts of Islam. And Islam is, unlike Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, Islam takes as its goal the imposition of its own law, its holy law, Sharia, not just to one part of the earth, but to all of the earth, and not just by convincing and persuading people, but by conquering people, by conquest. And the Islamic Jihad, starting from Muhammad, conquered huge swaths of the earth, including North Africa and Sudan, where they practiced in the 1990s and 2000s. What jihad has always practiced. I didn't know when I first started the anti-slavery movement about jihad. I just thought it was a religious war, a civil war, but then I learned more about what the precepts of jihad are, and this is what they do. This is what they've always done. They take women and children, and starting with, way back with the Jews. When Muhammad conquered the Jewish tribes, because he was angry that they didn't, that the Jews did not, were not persuaded that he was the prophet of God. He was very eager for them to be persuaded, because he was relying a lot on what in the world at that time revered, which was Jewish teaching, Torah, Moses, Abraham. And he wanted to kind of co-opt it, take it over. And he thought that the Jews would accept him as a prophet. And when they didn't, he slaughtered them and killed them and took their property and their wives and their children as slaves, just like in Sudan, 1800 years later. So this is not a matter of some strange marginal dudes who were radicals, on weed, on LSD, and got juiced up to do strange things. They were on the Quran. That was their drug of choice. And it's not to say that every Muslim does that, but it is to say that there is no successful, anyway, reform Islam that would reinterpret those elemental and fundamental precepts to modernize them, like as has happened in other religions. There is no, I know personally people, Muslims, who are trying to create such a thing, and I wish them the best, but it's hard to see how they will be successful.
Well, we have a statement by the President of the United States that has bothered me for 19 years. And it's a corollary to what you were just discussing, Charles. Not long after 9/11, President Bush appeared at a Muslim center and talked about the fact that Islam is and always has been a religion of peace, and that the hijackers, and I'm paraphrasing obviously, hijacked this religion, and they are not representative of the religion. Now, by this time, I'd already read the Quran, and it seemed to me that they were good, devout followers of the teachings of Muhammad and were waging jihad against the infidel, meaning America. What do you make of President Bush's statement that, in my mind, misled 300 million Americans who were grieving horribly into believing that Islam is nonviolent and people who are violent, that create violence or wage jihad in the name of Islam, are bad Muslims and are heretics?
Well, this is either a matter of cowardice or ignorance or political calculation. The political calculation of these sorts of people, leaders in the West, goes something like this internally. There's a billion Muslims in the world or more. We can't beat them in a war, so we have to accommodate to them and hope that they will become modernized if we accept them into Western societies, and maybe they will become assimilated and leave and moderate their views or even leave the religion. Now, it's either that or complete ignorance. It's how can anybody say that Islam is the religion of peace? I mean, it's the biggest laugh line, if you did a comedy routine. All you've got to do is read Islamic history. You don't even have to do that. All you have to do is Google the word jihad, modern jihad, jihad 1952, jihad 1953, and you'll find, terrorist attacks in the name of Islam by people who are screaming Allah Akbar. And you'll also find preachers, Muslim preachers, all over the Muslim world saying these precepts. So if Islam were the religion of peace, what you would find is something quite different. You would find preachers standing up, imams, articulate, wonderfully articulate imams, who would be saying something like this: you know, it used to be that in Islam, we believed that Islam had to be supreme over any other religion. We no longer believe that. It used to be that we couldn't allow Christians and Jews and others to live equally in Muslim majority states. We no longer believe that, and they now can. Well, you don't find that. That's just not happening all over the world. You don't find people denying, reneging on, overturning all of the main precepts of traditional Islam. So if there were a religion of peace named Islam, that's what you would see. You know, it's damn few, if you could find any. Well, you can a few, but they're the tiny, tiny, tiniest and marginalized and most attacked and vulnerable, you know, people in the world who might say something like that. But
so let me stop you there. I agree 100%. If there was more than 100%, I would agree with you more than that. Why is it, Charles, the president wasn't corrected? There was no fact-checking from the media. Nobody in Congress stood up and goes, wait a minute, I have a Quran. I've read it. What religion is he talking about? Religion of peace. I mean, the one religion that never was involved in any war, I guess, was Buddhism. But Buddhists aren't blowing up buildings and hacking people to death and blowing themselves up in nightclubs or hacking people on London Bridge, right? Where was the media? Where was the Congress? Where were the Christian and Jewish leaders to stand up and go, Mr. President, with all due respect, read the Quran and restate your religion of peace position, because you're talking about some other religion. What happened to those people? Where were they?
Well, first of all, you have to understand that the people who were going to get platforms are people who already have ideologies that are against saying that truth about that, right? I mean, the entire media structure has been captured, and the academic world has been captured by the left. And the left has a very, very different view of this. The left actually is looking for Muslims to replace the working class that never revolted. You remember the left's theory was that the working class of the world unite, and that it was inevitable that they would, and that they would overthrow the evil capitalist world. Well, it didn't work out that way. The Western working classes were too busy shopping at Walmart and ignored this foolishness, because they understood that they, even when they worked for nasty capitalist bosses, it was better than anything else the world had on offer. And so the left went for the third world. The third world was going to replace the white working class. And all of a sudden, out of the third world, the most rebellious ones there, who were ready to fight anybody, the capitalists, were the Muslims. And so they felt that they were eventually going to be their allies. But they were prophetic, because now we have a red-green alliance. So all the people on the left were not going to say to George Bush, wait a minute, go read the Quran. Also because they thought all religion is poppycock, you know, the opiate of the people. And, you know, as soon as people understood what their true belief structures ought to be, as soon as they got rid of false consciousness, as soon as they found out that it was capitalism that was the enemy, and all religious people, all religion was telling them to, you know, have an inner life that was important more than an outer life, a political life. So the left was against all religions too. But when they saw the potential for recruiting Muslims to overthrow capitalism, they were not going to say the truth about what was in the Quran. They would obfuscate it. Then you had people who were afraid and who didn't know. I would say those two things, ignorance and fear. So most Americans who don't know about the Quran or don't know about history, right? I mean, we all have given up the study of history. They think that all religions are the same kind of, well, we have Judaism, we have Christianity. Well, Islam must be kind of like that. You know, we have Jesus, we have Moses, and they have Muhammad. And, you know, so it's kind of the same thing. So if we're not going to be against religion as Americans and we're going to keep religion apart from running the state, okay, so there'll be a new religion. It'll be Muhammad.
Well, let's take
right? I mean, this is ridiculous.
Let's insert something here, Charles.
Yeah.
The Jews I know, the Christians I know, if they are somewhat observant, follow some of the rules, and show up on Friday or Saturday or Sunday and the big holidays. Islam is not just a religion. It's a political system. It's an economic system. It's a dietary system. It's a social structure. It's a political movement. It is completely an all-encompassing way of life. I don't disagree with your theory. Well, we don't condemn religion, even if they have some goofy precepts. Islam is a doctrine, as you said earlier, for nothing short of world domination. Not from a religious sense, from a political, economic, religious, dietary, every possible permutation of a version of how you live your life from the time you wake up to the time you go to bed, and the afterlife is all there in the book.
Right, but nobody taught this. How was American? What was it? It was only individual, independent scholars who were reading books like this. Most Americans don't read books like that. Most Americans are taught silly things about a lot of things, so they didn't know. I mean, it's not that most Americans read the Quran like you did or like I did and came away saying to themselves, well, I better not say this stuff. No, the politicians said, we better not say this stuff. Most Americans are clueless, absolutely clueless. I have a cousin who's a lefty and he teaches in Berkeley. And I argued with him about everything in the world. And I said, so what do you think about Islam? He said, I never think about it. I don't know. Do you know what it says? It's another religion. So it's, I think, massive ignorance. And from the point of view of many people, that serves their interests. That serves their interests. I mean, I'll tell you, right here in Boston, the largest mosque on the Eastern Seaboard is here in Boston. It came here through an effort by people who pretended to be moderate Muslims, but who actually were in the Muslim Brotherhood, linked to it, linked to terror organizations.
Let me interrupt you 1 second. Yeah. Tell our audience what the Muslim Brotherhood is, because if people are as uninformed as you say, they don't know what that means.
Well, the Muslim Brotherhood is a movement that came out of a kind of a modernist awakening of modern day jihadist Islam that came from people who, Muslim scholars, Saeed Qutb and others, who asked themselves, what's wrong? Turkey, the last caliphate, was defeated by the West. The Muslims are now suffering, humiliated by the West. How could this have happened when we had such power all throughout the generations before this, and now we're nothing? How could this have happened? And the answer is that our people turned away from the most fundamental structures of and strictures of Islam. And we now have to rebuild that. And they built a movement, to a jihadist movement, to take, to transform all those Muslims who were kind of not inspired at the moment to overthrow anymore because they've been defeated, and to rejuvenate them and rekindle the Muslim political movement worldwide. And this eventually became the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the central fount of all or most of Islamic terrorism in the world. And it's spread throughout many, many countries. And America, we found their secret plan. There was a famous case in Texas, the Holy Land Trial, where American authorities actually captured the planning book for jihad in America. Our friend Stephen Emerson did a movie about it. People can read about it, where it says, our job in America is to have jihad and to transform the constitutional government of this country into Sharia law. And that's what we're going to do. And we're going to do it by planting mosques and by teaching our people the right holy way of Islam. And that's what they said. And a branch of that, people connected to that, came to Boston, and that's exactly what they did. They convinced the mayor of the city, Mayor Menino at the time, since deceased. They said, we need a mosque. We've got Muslim students here. We've got Muslim scientists here. We've got a lot of people. We need a mosque. So the mayor actually gave them a piece of land, city land, for hardly any money at all. He practically gave it a multi-million-dollar piece of land for free. And he gave it to people who, had he known who they really were, he wouldn't have let them off the plane at Logan Airport. For example, Yusuf Karadawi is the spiritual head of the Muslim Brotherhood. Any one of our listeners now tonight can, with the spelling of his name on your laptop and hitting a button on Google, you'll find Yusuf Karadawi all throughout the Muslim world screaming to throngs of people that they have to take over the world, that they have to kill every Jew on the planet, that et cetera, et cetera. So these guys come into Boston, and the mayor didn't really know who they were. We tried to tell them, but he didn't want to know, because he was delusional. He wanted to think that Islam was just like Judaism and Christianity. And if he were to deny them a piece of land, they would call him bigot. And he didn't want to be called bigot, because nobody wants to be called racist and bigot, because that's the biggest power ideological weapon that the left has. And it stings. It stings. Well, and since there was no understanding of what Islam was, they were just going to let them have this. And in effect, what they had was, one of my board members, Dennis Hale, Professor Dennis Hale, said, they created a jihad academy. And they eventually, their goal was to, in some way you can use this word, politicize or radicalize the historically more moderate, quiescent New England Muslim community. And they did. And they are doing it. And we found my director of research, Ilya Feyerkhtistov, who can find anything, found what they're teaching Boston Muslims. And it ain't nice, Barry. It's not nice. And this group, they built a mosque, and they built actually two mosques. And 14 or maybe 13 or 14 or 15 people who were congregants of that mosque are now either dead from terrorism, running away from federal authorities or local authorities from terrorist acts that they've perpetrated, or in jail. So we're having our little jihad here in Boston, and nobody pays attention, because if you do like we do, and you monitor this and you publish it and you report it and you go to the FBI and you go to the police and you go to the mayor. We are sued for defamation and called bigots. So this is the real problem. You can't say the truth about these things, even when it's right in front of your nose, even when two of the congregants of the Islamic Society of Boston blew up the Boston Marathon.
Well, let's talk for a second about why it is that even when there is a 9/11 or a Boston Marathon or the discotheque in Florida or Fort Hood or San Bernardino, so it's not like it's a one-off, you know what I mean, where a drunk driver drives off the bridge and kills five people in a parking lot. But it's obvious. I mean, it's obvious that there is a unifying philosophy worldwide, whether it's the Hebdo massacre in Paris or the London Bridge or the concert in Manchester. I mean, it's all over the world on a consistent basis, Charles. Why is it that people and the press are unable to call it what it is? It's almost like it's absolutely pouring outside. And the weatherman says, well, today it's a little bit not sunny. Let's move on to sports. They can't come out and say the words jihad. They can't come out and say Islamic terror. Why is it? Tell me.
Because the left has stolen the language.
And so what is that? Wait a minute. Let's stop. What does that mean?
That means that if you don't believe that all people are the same and good, then you're a racist and a bigot. And how dare you say that? All people must be, and all cultures are have equal moral claim. And all people want the same thing for their children and their lives. And those things are good, have a nice house, you know. And there's a few nuts. If you don't believe that, you will be tarred and feathered by society. And that's why, and that's the danger of the left winning the culture wars in America. You know, well, that every student right now, starting from kindergarten, are taught a set of principles that are absolutely the opposite of the truth. I mean, I can name a few of them, right? All cultures are the same. Darker-skinned people and poor people have a higher moral claim on any issue. The only reason we have conflict is misunderstanding and miscommunication. The only reason for wars is because some people have more than others, and the way to peace is to redistribute the wealth so that everybody has the same. That's what's being taught. And if you go against it, and now especially, you know, like 20 years ago, you could argue against this stuff. Now, if you argue against this, you can get beat up. You can get shamed. And it's the most foolish thing in the world. And it comes to this. You know, classic liberals, and I consider myself a classic liberal, and probably you are too in this sense, believe that all people should be treated equally and given an equal opportunity, no matter the color of their skin, their gender, their this, their that, and that. Okay, but that's not you know what's taken over from that and defeated that is a demand for equality of results in such a way that it says if there's a performance gap between two peoples, right? If Jews make better lawyers than blacks. Whatever the performance gap is anywhere, the only reason for it is that the people on top oppressed the people on the bottom and stole from them. That's the only since everybody's equal, the only possible explanation is that those who are doing better illicitly, that they live on undeserved wealth. They have undeserved power. So everything that we have that's not equal is illicit. And the reason it is because the capitalists try to drive the victims against each other. So if you say something about Islam, you are perpetrating the capitalist power system against one of the victim classes. Crazy. You could say this is crazy, right? But that's actually what people are being taught.
So let me be clear. Are you saying to me that because of this bizarre suppression / victim theology, if you can paint somebody as the victim, those victims are unable to be labeled as perpetrators of any crime against society?
Well, you know this, because blacks can't be called racist, even if they hate, even if they go around saying we hate white people. Muslims can't be oppressed because they're darker skinned, and the poor Palestinians suffer from Israeli white oppression. You know, women can't be evil because men have always lorded their power over them. Gays can't be mean because, you know, they're innocent. Victims are innocent. Or if they've done bad things, it's only because they were forced to do bad things by their oppressors. So Muslims...
You realize that sounds insane, right?
Well, I realize it sounds insane, but it's being taught throughout American schools. You know, you realize what the Muslims did actually in America was beat the Jews out of their own position. The Jews were, most of the Jews were liberals and friends and allies of progressive causes, of liberal causes, right? Friends of the blacks, in the forefront of the civil rights movement, in the forefront of the gay marriage movement, in the forefront of, you know, freedom for workers and Latinos and women's rights and gay, all that, right? All of a sudden you have, imagine this. All of a sudden you have American Muslims who in their societies are against every one of those things I said. They're racist. They call blacks abid, slave, same word, right? Gays, they throw from the rooftops. Women, they cut off genitals and beat them, you know, etc. Democracy they don't like. And all of a sudden, they have replaced the Jews because they've become victims, as are the blacks. And more than anybody else who is gaining from this Black Lives Matter thing is the Muslims, because they're racing into the cause and they're yelling against white cops and they're saying the Jews are white. And they're saying the Jews send cops over to Israel to train how to beat people of color up, like the Palestinians. They have defeated American Jewish groups.
Okay,
It's shocking.
Hold that thought. I want to ask you specifically a Jewish question. Muslims who are speaking out from the pulpit in Islamic centers from coast to coast rail against Jews.
Yep.
Some, I mean, I'm so uncomfortable having to say it as if I'm revealing some secret that people don't know about and I shouldn't say it because it's not polite, are talking about genocide against Jews. I don't mean somebody in a basement in Beirut or the Grand Mosque in Tehran. I mean, in Islamic centers from Boston to Los Angeles to Houston to San Francisco, Minneapolis, they are literally preaching the Quran. If you find a Jew behind the rock, right, or behind the tree, pick up Barack and kill him. I mean, it is ferociously anti-Semitic, and it is obvious in its call for open genocide against Jews. Yes or no, am I right?
Of course you're right. All you got to do is look at memory.com or memory.org, I'm not sure which, M-E-M-R-I, and you can, you know, find preachers, Muslim preachers, calling for the death of Jews and calling Jews devils and sons of monkeys and pigs, and we have to defeat them, and yes.
Okay, so here's my question. Thank you for that. I sort of knew the answer.
Yeah.
And obviously you do too.
Yeah, but you know what? You know who else knows the answer? The leaders of the American Jewish community know the answer, and they run away from it. They don't want to see anything. They want to marginalize it. They want to tell us that the biggest problem is neo-Nazis.
So let's talk about this. Why in the world, Charles, are the leading Jewish spokespeople, ADL, UJF, Jewish Committee, whatever you want to call it, the prominent rabbis that have either a pulpit in front of large congregations or microphones, where are their words of indignation and revulsion? How in the world can Jewish organizations after Jewish organizations say, we're all brothers, there's a few outliers, but that's not the way they really are? Why are they bending over into pretzel-like positions to make it okay that they are making friends with who I consider to be potentially genocidal maniacs?
Here's the answer. Listen, it's an outrage. They have betrayed the Jews. The ADL, the biggest betrayer. The ADL does surveys of anti-Semitism, and they do them fairly competently. And recently they came up with, where are the biggest problems of anti-Semitism? And they had a scale, you know, if you answered yes to these 15 questions, if you answer 10 of them yes, that makes you really, really dangerous. 3 of them yes, not so much. So they scaled these questions and they asked around the world. And it turns out that in Muslim societies, you have by far the largest percentage of deeply vicious anti-Semitism. So, Mort Klein, who is my friend, who is the head of ZOA, goes to Congress, and he is, along with the ADL, are testifying about the dangers of anti-Semitism, and Klein mentions the ADL's own findings. Why aren't we looking at mosques? Mort says. Why? Listen to this speech, what this guy, this Muslim imam says. What about this? What about that? What about this? He says, even the ADL says it, right? So the woman from the ADL gets up there and she's trying to say that the biggest problem is on the right. And I'll tell you why she does that. But so.
Whoa.
Now this is on, we have it on film. We've shown this. She says the biggest problem is on the right. So somebody says to her, but wait a minute. Klein just showed us that around the world, the largest concentration and the largest problem about is anti-Semitism of any group, any culture, any continent comes from the Arab world. And she says, well, because the Muslim peoples in America are among the victim classes, we don't say that. That's what she said. I'll send you the film. It's on the film. Because we don't want to make their lives worse. They're already, you know, they're already not doing so well in this country. There's a lot of people don't like them. You know, why should we say anything bad about them? That was the intent of what she said. The exact words I forget, but it's pretty close. And I'll send you the tape. You should play it on your thing. So it's the left Jews who run the Jewish organizations who are embracing the left. They fear to be kicked out of this alliance of victims. They're embracing this alliance of victims. Meanwhile, they're getting kicked in the teeth, being called white patriarchal oppressors, because they have nothing else to do. They don't know what else to do. What are they going to do? Become Republicans? What are they going to do? Have a jihad against? They're stuck. They're like a deer in the headlight. It's the biggest problem the Jewish community has, the failure of their leadership.
Oh my God. I'm stunned and I got to be honest, really discouraged. We have some questions from our viewers or listeners, I should say. Let me shoot some of them at you. Dave asked, why is it 19 years after 9/11 we have more devout Muslims running for office than ever before? Did America learn nothing from 9/11?
Well, America can't stop them from running. America could not vote for them. There are large efforts across the Muslim community in America to run for office. They collect money. They get money from overseas. They get money from liberals. They get money from their leftist allies. They run alongside with their leftist allies. I mean, it's the squad idea, right? So you're going to have blacks, Muslims, gays, women, Latinos, LGBT, XYZ, whatever. You're going to have them be a force. And you know what? The other team members like the Muslim force because they bring money and they bring energy to it. So, you know, the Muslims are not running openly to say, you know, tomorrow if I'm elected, I'm going to impose Sharia law. No, they're very smart. They say they hone to the leftist programming. We're going to have better schools. We're going to have tax the rich, healthcare for everybody. You know, forget about college debt. You know, so they're. They fit in for now, into the leftist cadres.
So if I can interpret your answer, Charles, I would say, and tell me if you agree with what I'm going to tell you, that from the perspective of the progressive, wildly left wing, anyone that enhances their agenda is an ally. And from the Muslim perspective, same thing, only the difference is when they, this coalition, obtain power, at some point, if a jihadist is in office and there's not two or three squad members, but 200, they will eat everybody else.
Yeah, I think the left doesn't understand that they will be eaten. You know, I mean, they still go around in a way with the old Marxist notion that religion is the opiate of the people and it's just a silly thing. And when everybody has a good job that the socialist economy brings to them and no one's oppressed anymore by white racism, then they'll forget all this Allah stuff, you know. Well, they're not going to forget. You know, by the way, one good thing I read recently is that there are many Muslims, more than we had hoped, I think, leaving the faith and even organizing against it. You can go and find on the internet, you know, ex-Muslim groups, and they're doing better than we could have hoped. So... you know, we even published something recently where the imams at the, or some of the officials in the Islamic Society of Boston were complaining that the young Muslims were weren't doing their religious duties, were being seduced away by liberal society, and were not being righteous and pious. Well, that's a good thing.
Okay, next question from Maria. Why do people, including non-Muslims, think or say Israel was behind 9/11?
Because they're anti-Semites. I mean, how, you know, my God. I mean, you know, let's remember the Jews, hatred of the Jews has always taken a couple of classic forms. You know, we use Christian blood to make matzah, we poison the wells. Whatever the worst thing in the world you could think of, the Jews did it. So, you know, if 9/11 was the worst thing in the world, well, the Jews must have done it. So it's nothing new. It's despicable. It's, you know, people like that are just not worth, you know, your breath on. But it's not new.
All right. Stephen asks, do you think there's any way the West, let alone women and minorities, are going to survive the massive Muslim immigration that's going on now?
Well, we don't know. I mean, they're not doing so well about this in Europe, you know. Talk about women, you know, the rapes in Europe are hidden. You know, that's the other thing. You know, you ask about why in America we don't say the truth. Well, you've got this scandal in England where, and in Denmark, where there are massive rapes by Muslim men of Western women. And, you know, when the guy gets arrested, he's called an Asian, right? Or, I mean, the police hid it. And it's scandalous. What will happen in America? Who knows what's going to happen in America? Everything is topsy-turvy, up in the air. One never knows. And then, you know, it could be that at least some of the Muslims will be seduced by reason and enlightenment and Western culture and leave. We just don't know what's going to happen. But it is a huge danger. It's certainly a bigger danger than the neo-Nazis.
Oh, I could not agree with you more. Charles, thanks a million for your time tonight. It's been a true pleasure. Please tell our listeners how they can find out what Charles Jacobs does and where they can find out about your work.
You can find out about our work about fighting Islamic supremacism and jihad in America at peaceandtolerance.org, peaceandtolerance.org. And you can find out about our work trying to bring attention to the enslavement of blacks by jihadists all over Africa at iabolish.org, the letter iabolish.org. And I want to thank you, Barry, for having me on and having this really interesting conversation.
Believe me, it's our pleasure, and I'm sure those people out in American Truth Project land appreciate you greatly. And to our wonderful, loyal listeners for tuning in tonight, I want to remind you that to get notifications of future shows and all of our content absolutely free on your cell phone, if you're in the United States, please text the word TRUTH, T-R-U-T-H, and send it to 88202. The word TRUTH sent to 88202. You'll be subscribed automatically to our free text message alert system. You'll learn about this and all of our shows sometimes in advance, so you can join in and listen on radio, whether it's a Facebook Live or one of our regular episodes. You'll always get notified, and there's never a charge. Again, for ATP Report on Radio, thanks for joining us. This is Barry Nussbaum.
You were listening to ATP Radio. Make sure to text the word TRUTH, T-R-U-T-H, to 88202 to be notified of our future radio show.